Blue Earth. So it's around Mankato. This is a Minnesota book. I'm from Brooklyn. It doesn't make any sense. Agriculture to me was growing the top of a carrot in the bottom of a milk container on the windowsill for a project. That was agriculture. But I lived here before, and I left. I came back, and I had been sort of haunted by a number of things, including seeing people living in houses, which I thought was a remarkable thing because I only knew apartments. I didn't understand what it meant to own a house, to have a place, have a yard, have a car. As well, I was sort of very taken and very haunted by sort of those visions of the farmlands, which were really like what I had seen in paintings. And they just kind of stayed with me, and I started working on this book when I didn't live here, and I finished it essentially when I didn't live here. So I'm sure I can be put up against the wall and asked how a person from Brooklyn could dare to write this book. I'm nothing if not daring in certain ways. I'd like to just introduce it a little bit. Because it does, it takes place in Minnesota, actually in Minneapolis, and some out in the farmlands around Mankato, which is Blue Earth County. It takes place in the 80s and 90s, sort of that starts with the kind of height of the farm crisis and of the loss of family farms. But what sits in people, what seems to sit in this place very heavily, among many things, is the taking of millions and millions of acres of land from Native people. And that sort of always sits in my back somehow. And as well, the whole question of historical amnesia is one that I'm always working with, because I'm always seeing that people seem to form their vision of the world without remembering where the present moment came from. We all do it. We do it to be people. We do it to leave tragedy behind. We do it to leave our families behind in certain ways. We do it for many reasons. But that whole question of historical amnesia fascinated me. So there's numbers of characters, and they're very pushy characters, and there's a bunch of them. The central character is Carver, who's a farmer who lost his land. His wife and daughter walked out before the auction. And he's an interesting guy. I never intended to write about him. He becomes fascinated with a little girl named Angie, who's the daughter of a wonderful working class couple. She's a beautiful little girl. They're folks who've been really put upon, really worked hard, really been through a lot. There's Carver's girlfriend Mary, sometimes. His ex-wife Katie, their daughter Rosie. And then there are two Native characters, Dakota, who wouldn't let me not write them, though I didn't feel adequate to do so. But it seemed hard to tell this story without their presence, and so they're here as well. So I'm gonna put these on and pretend I don't have them on because I don't. I'm gonna start. Carver leaves his farm and he moves to the cities. He works at a gas station and he's pretty pissed off. That kind of sums him up. But here's a scene where he first meets a couple of the other characters. Carver was half dozing at the cash register as afternoon was falling to night. No one had been in for about an hour, and the radio was insistent with news of the next snowstorm. The heater he shared with the owner's dog was buzzing on and off like a slow heartbeat that lit up the darkness under the counter. He was in the woods. The old man behind him. This is how I can run away. And he pushed through the brush with his hands and darted between the trees like a fox. He was clever to keep running, to escape another beating, to live long enough to become a man. Because this time, he thought, the old man will kill me. grab the breath right out of me with the words, I have given you life and I can take it away, you ingrate, you complainer, you girl. He saw his own body fall into the leaves and beginning to decompose into the richness of the soil run through by roots of trees and wild sweet grasses. And there on the ground, his mouth was open and blood ribboned its way out from the darkness of his silence as the man raised his hand to him again with a bottle, or was it a tool from out of the barn? And the ribbon of blood was the road of insects who buzzed and crawled into his skull as country travelers, hungry for what was there, streamed into the city to make another life away from the green lands fenced off and stolen. He woke and put his hands up to the sockets of his eyes to feel the full round orbs under their worn lids. He stumbled into the restroom and spat into the sink to cut the red road that was how life left when his father blamed him, when he wrapped his stone arms around Carver and squeezed him in a vice of rage as if he would slaughter him while his mother was asleep, his brother away in the war, and only the spindly legs of the kitchen table stood to witness. Your brother's not coming back, I can tell it. I want to know what God had in mind to take Elias and leave me with you. In his mind, Carver struck the old man, then pounded away at him like a jackhammer until his soft hand somehow broke the unbreakable, the stone skull of the man. Out spilled his thoughts, out spilled his curses, out spilled his ways, and all of it could be swept up from the floor and tossed into the compost pile for his mother's garden. But then he said, no. And he laughed out loud over the sink, opened his eyes to his worn face, and said again into the mirror, no, nothing would flower from what spilled out. Better to burn it. That was the evening he first saw William in the passenger seat, the old orange truck, when he leaned over the side door to clean the window, though he didn't want to. But the woman said, please, could you wash that side so my nephew can look out? He loves to see the buildings passing and the street lights come on. Sure, why not, he told her, though he didn't want to. Didn't matter whether the boy could see out or not. The city wasn't a show. Boy should just sit in the truck and keep his mouth shut. He pushed the cloth over the stains of the weather, the miracle cells of frost, which he had to destroy, stars into glass, and revealed in the slash of his work the very dark, very large eyes of a boy staring out at him. The woman had gone to the restroom, so he bent over and stuck his face almost against the clean window, right in the boy's sight, figuring the kid would jump out of his skin, but he didn't move a muscle. He just stared back at Carver, then blew on the beaded headdress hanging from the rearview mirror so it swung up and back. Why, you little, Carver muttered, and his right arm tensed in the cold air, and then heat flowed into his fist, still holding the wet cloth. But again the boy did not move, just kept looking at him, and nothing came into the man's mind that could close those eyes, that could move the gaze away from his face. Mister, he heard the woman call him, and he sneered into the window at the child and raised himself up from the truck. What do you need? He asked her, as he always would, though he could see himself chop off each long braid that snaked down over her shoulders and her large breasts, her build visible even through the heavy jacket. She walked up to him. I brought you a cup of coffee from inside, she said. It's pretty cold out here. She shoved the steaming cup into his ungloved hand, and it did warm him. And then she went rummaging through some packages in the back of the truck. She lifted up both arms and looked like a kid for a moment, he thought, happy at discovering something. I was worried I might have left these back at the cabin, she said, walking toward him with a plate covered over with tin foil. Have some cookies, she urged, and lifted the foil to reveal them. Nuts and chocolate, she pointed, and better than store-bought. Just one, he mumbled. Thanks, and stood holding the steaming coffee and the cookie, still warm, though he knew it was impossible, as they drove off. Damn woman, he said, after they had disappeared down the street, and threw the cookie into the trash, but drank with both hands around the cup the dark liquid. The way I like it, at least, he thought. black, one sugar. He stamped on the hard ground for warmth and heard the ring of his boots repeating until the soles of his feet burned with the impact. He wondered about her, too stupid to know who she was dealing with, and drank the coffee down to the half-visible brand name raised in the bottom of the cup. Chippewa, he made out, and laughed then, crushed the cup, and went inside to wait for customers. I'm going to read another piece of it, and then maybe we can stop for a while and talk, and then if you can hang in, I'll read another little bit after that. This kind of gets, now one thing that's interesting to me is that I got sort of inhabited by this guy who is not me, I swear. He is so, like, so not me, right? This guy. And he just wouldn't go away. The book started as a story about beauty and ugliness. You know, it doesn't seem to have much to do with it, but it actually does. And Carver is somebody with a lot of opinions about what is and what should be. And it just grew, and he kind of came to life, thanks very much, and took over and hung around with me. So nobody in here is rationally thought up. Trust me on that. But they are fishy. Okay. So this actually comes after he has a little bit of an argument with a friend of his. He's got this friend. He's sort of very obsessed with this little girl, Angie, who's this beautiful, perfect little heartland beauty. I won't say it again. It's a private joke. But and he actually rescues her from a tornado. Serious business. He really does. And that's complicated. But her parents, her father is named August. He's a real skinny guy, so he's known as Mopstick. And so he and Carver, for some reason, hang out, even though Mopstick is actually one of the sweetest guys around. And I've heard some very nasty things said about Carver, people who have known him. In any case, they've had a little spat because Carver's pretty insistent about what men are entitled to. And one of those things that they're entitled to is beauty. It's a certain kind of beauty. And Mopstick got a little pissed off at him. So Carver's in the coffee shop, and he's just trying to get over it because Mopstick left. So here's Carver. He tried to read the newspaper and made himself look at the prices corn and soy were pulling in. He drank some cold water from the pitcher Tess had left and watched the slice of lemon float to the bottom and bob back up. It was a glossy leaflet from the community college, like a big playing card inserted in the papers, inviting new students to come and change their lives. He scanned the list of degrees they offered, a course in forgetting. He thought, that would be great. I should get a degree in that. You in college, boy? He heard his father say, you've got to be kidding me. Your brother was a good student, but you? You'd always be on the prowl for girls. Not that I blame you. That's pretty normal. The right side of Carver's head throbbed with it. His father's voice, the pictures that went along with it. Tess, he yelled out, trying to quiet it. I'll have that refill now. Now, I am a preacher, albeit unofficial, his father told him in the kitchen one Sunday night, pointing his finger at his young son, but a fine preacher, a true and holy speaker, a voice that grew up from this land, a preacher with power like the thunder. Right, boy? You know, I can preach to the farmer, and he asks me for comfort, and I am there for him with the knowledge of our Lord and the blessing sent to me from heaven to cast onto those who labor on earth, who labor in sorrow, as the wicked make confused the true nature of man and earth. The boy looked away. You hear me, Carver? Yes, I hear you. But I am a man, and in a few years you'll be a man, and you'll feel what I'm feeling in my body today. I am a man, and I have to confess before your mother walks into this room talking some nonsense or other, that new woman working down at the exchange makes my blood boil with it. You know what I mean, kid of mine? I can't sleep at night if I start thinking about her. her full thighs, the rounded bowl of her belly that offers up its wine to a good man like me. I could get lost in her hair, lost in her flesh. She's a hot one. You can tell it, can't you? Sure, sure, I can tell it. And he looked past his father through the kitchen window. The old man pounded his fist on the table. A man needs some beauty in his life. Your mother's an old beast by now. A hard worker, sure enough, but I need to look at a face that's a flower, not an old sack of grain. Carver stood up and opened his mouth to say something, but the man grabbed his arm and pulled him back down to the table. Did I tell you to get up? Did I? His son didn't answer, feeling the wounds of his mother who cared for him each time he was hurt or beaten. The farmer put his face close to the boy's and stared at him, but then Carver looked him in the eye and said, "Why do you talk that way about my mother?" The man snickered and shook his head. "Beauty is beauty," he said, "and goddamned ugly is nothing but god-blasted ugly. There's no virtue in it." Carver looked down at his hands, which were hurting as if he had been milking all day. "Got it, boy?" his father said, and pointed hard in his son's face. "Ugly over here, at the edge of things, and beauty here." He circled his finger around and around and stopped at the center of the table, the garden, the blessed and holy place, the place of good food and abundant drink, and at the edge, the barren places. God don't waste. He pounded the table with each word, on those that don't deserve, and he marks them, you hear me, boy? He marks them so we all can tell, don't waste a minute on this one. God ain't stupid. He made the world for those he likes to look upon. The man's words were coming slower. No flaw in the beloved. The good book says it. Can I go now? The boy asked. No, you can't go. I was telling you about this woman down at the store, the one God wants me to have, the beautiful Helen. Like in the Greek story. You read that story in school yet? I'll tell you, she was so beautiful they fought a war for her. And Carver saw the great horse filled with soldiers who leaped out with swords and shouts to take her home. This woman was perfect. Full breasts, long legs, none of this stumpy stuff like a draft horse. Golden hair, nothing dark in her except the shadows a man goes into. And that face, sweet lips, he puckered his own and kissed at the air. A flower face. You know what that means? A flower face. Do you? No, said Carver, watching through the window as the ocean of grain moved to the caress of the wind. I didn't think so. A flower face is one that opens to the sunlight, and the sun is you, the man. Get it? A flower face opens up to you and is soft and smells good. He inhaled, but the boy felt like he was choking. Like honeysuckle, the man said after the exhale. You, the scent of her breath like spring blossoms. Her tongue tasted of milk and honey. To lay with her in the fields brings peace to a man. The Lord says it right there in the Bible. He was calm then and leaned closer to the boy. You can't drink from a cursed ugly face. From the leather skin of a woman out in the sun dried up from chores, you have to be able to suck. A man is like a baby. See, a man has to be able to suck in his woman, and it has to be sweet, like a flower face. That's a woman not for work. That's a woman for love. That's the way a man survives. First, he gets a woman who works hard, and then he gets what he deserves, a woman for loving, one to dwell with him in the garden. Don't you read the good book, boy? Can I go now? Carver asked again, working to ease his hand out of his father's grip. As it slid away, the man looked down at his empty hand, confused, as if something had been cut away. Who do you think you are? I'm telling you something, you 13-year-old brat, something you need to know if you're going to grow to be a man. And then he backhanded the boy hard across the face so that his chair fell onto the kitchen floor. Get up, his father said, and Carver did. Now you can go. But the boy stood there this time, ready for what was to come. Did you hear me? I said, get out of my sight. The boy did not move, dreaming as he was upright of a victory over the lined and ugly face of the man still in his suit jacket from church. I'm not moving, he dared say, until I want to. What did you say? The man said as he struck out at his son as hard as he could and felled him. The boy stood up again and shook his head in the light of the moon, and the father saw it, something wild and hard, something he could not put back, and heard it without knowing where it came from, a sound bellowing and rare that ran with the boy out into the fields, where he paced the straight path of the rose, then bent to the furrows to smell the earth he couldn't imagine opening to his father. He lay there, breathing the night. From his room, Carver heard his father walking again, up and down the stairs, through the hallway, shuffling his feet, passing his door like a slow, sad wind, and then the creaking of the suitcase of the staircase again. The refrigerator door swung open and then shut, and Carver's father kept walking. When the boy heard no more, he went downstairs to make sure the man hadn't fallen asleep at the kitchen table again, and there he was, but he was awake in the dim light and weeping. Carver's mother was there, cradling him in her soft arms, stroking his head as he sobbed, but Carver couldn't hear a thing and looked hard for a few more moments to make sure they were really there. "Oh, love," she whispered to her husband in the dark, "lay down the past." Carver looked up, just as the fluorescent light buzzed and flickered in his eyes. "Tess," he shouted toward the other end of the long, curved counter. "This should settle up." And he slapped a 20 on the paper placemat right in the center of the big green map of Minnesota. I'm going to stop reading a bit. And I do want to remember, I wanted to dedicate this reading to a friend of mine who died last Tuesday. And he'd been sick for a while. I bet some people here would recognize his face if they saw him. He danced. He did a lot of salsa. It's very pertinent in a sense, besides that he's a dear friend, Jose Kohler. But he was a Chicano guy from Texas, and he started working in the fields as a child. So it's just another part of that immense story of, I think, of displacement, of labor, of farming, and all that it really implies in this country and everywhere. So I wanted to dedicate that to Jose Kohler. But I want to stop for a while, which is hard sometimes to really do. But David told me I can't read the whole book, so I was, because I was, you know, he could call him for pizza. But in any case, I just wanted to open this up to any response or any tomato throwing or any questions. Yeah.
And that was a very powerful cast that you wrote, and I think it's probably true in a lot of situations that happen like that, especially when times are hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sort of awestruck with how explicit your narrative is about child abuse, you know, I'm going to name it, but just, wow.
It's, I mean, it and there's so many forms of it, aren't there? I mean, I think, you know, part of what, strangely, I remember, I started this book a really long time ago, actually, and not in this century. And people have asked me, have said, well, did you time it to, you know, be on the 150th anniversary of the Dakota conflict and of the mass execution of 38 Dakota in 1862? It's like, no, I really didn't time it. I tried for a long, long time to get this thing done and get it published. But indeed, it is the 150th anniversary of that. And there's someone at the Mankato Free Press did a little article on the book, and he read the book, and relating it to what the discussions that are going on in his county at this point, and that I hope are the discussions that are going on all over the state. But it seems to me that this is one of the central, this is one of the many central stories of this country. And I mean, I certainly hadn't, when I lived out east, I certainly didn't know this specific story.
I love how tough it is, how realistically tough, you know, what you're tapping into, and the, you know, the true violence, how disgustingly well you're, how disgusting the patriarchy that you're capturing is. And I know you, I know it's not you, you know. So it's sort of the classic writer's question, how, because it is so vile, what you're effectively portraying.
Good.
how do you, you know, and I know, Anya, how busy you are and everything, and, you know, how do you shift gears? You know, how do you not just be in a bath of toxicity all the time?
My immediate response was to kind of say I am in one. It's 2012, and it seemed to be a globally pretty toxic situation, but I know what you mean.
How do you be in that bath and be as productive, given everything it takes to survive?
I think I'm probably more productive because I can allow that to speak in me, because it comes into focus and it won't let me alone because I hear it anyway, I see it anyway, and it's here. So I think probably if I didn't have this, you'd be visiting me in an institution. So I think and that you know it's sort of. It's a kind of great victory for me personally to be able to bring this person. I didn't grow up near a farm or near a German American Lutheran. I don't think I ever knew a German American Lutheran. But I think that what I wanted to understand was the question of power and how it plays out in normal situations. And for me, what it was the that sort of biblical instruction to have dominion and everything that means. Have dominion over men over women, this country over that country, people of this race over people of that race, people of, you know, this sexuality over that, and adults over children. So everything of how power works. And I guess with Carver, I mean, I felt myself in a sense to be his opposite. So I think characters come, you know, that very paradigm of those who have power over us, we probably know more about them than they know about us. And so it was a chance to make concrete what I also knew, both as an individual and as a person who has been looking at these questions of power and how it plays out. You know, he became concrete. He became a very specific guy. That's the first time he was described as vile. He's been described as heinous. which I also was kind of pleased because no one can accuse me of being fluffy. So, and it's just, yeah.
But the other thing is that he just can't get it. And then in the next scene, he's an asshole adult. Just move on.
And that, you know, that entire, you know, where it comes from, how it circles, how it returns to, you know. I mean, and that and the cutting off of memory, what the cutting off of memory does, because Carver worked pretty hard to, you know, cut off memory. And so if you read, you know, you'll see, wait a minute, but doesn't he get it? And he's working really hard. And I think that's part of the global problem. It's a very hard work that we do to have lovely amnesia. I mean, I have it. I have an angel. I just got it, I swear. After the book was done. I think that it, you know, what happens on the larger level, what happens on the individual level, on the familial level, I mean, how all these things echo each other is something that I'm, you know, and for instance, also my Angie's mother, Mastic's wife, Barb, is someone who's very ill, and, you know, it's not a question of, it's metaphorically, you know, it stands for, I mean, it's, she's ill, and she's ill for various reasons, and I think real causes have real consequences, and in individuals' lives and in the larger choices that a society makes, so.
What's your life story? I sense that you're from New York, and you know, the great talk is a very loving person. You're writing about tough, painful things.
Yeah.
Is it fair to ask? There's a lot of
writers. I'm a brute.
a lot of writers are a lot. We all, but yeah. A lot of writers are angry, and maybe that's easier to put it out there.
Well, I'm angry about having not enough time to write. So then I'm angry just about it. No, I grew up in New York. I was the daughter of an immigrant and a first generation and they ran all over and they got killed a lot and I don't feel so American. It was rugged. I grew up in the projects in Brooklyn. I had a hard time, and I spent some years homeless in New York, which was a real party. And then I read a lot of books, and then I would like to read some more. The same problem, I'm angry because I don't have enough time to read books. But I'm also, you know, I survived by looking, not by not looking. And I made alliances. I was always moved by questions of injustice, probably because I figured I was on the end of a lot of it. But that's where my alliances, and they were more than alliances. I mean, the people I loved saw a lot, experienced a lot, and that's kind of... So that never stopped, especially. And that probably won't stop until I do. So yeah, but I'm not. I can be very angry. How many people have seen me lose it? but I'm in Minnesota, so now I'm nice.
We have no traffic.
What?
We have no traffic noise. So you're reading. So okay. It feels like you're back in New York.
Yeah. Thank you so much. So kind.
You said you could be very angry. What makes you angry?
Well, basically that more than anything. When people get joy and money from other people's suffering, get a sense of power from other people's powers, and that, you know, that's it. Like, really annoying, stupid people can make me angry. No, there is no such thing. There is no such thing. But, you know, like, we've got, what's his name? Aiken. I mean, it's beyond even anger. It's more anger at a system that that guy's making more money than I am. He could read and write. He could make something of himself, but he just can't. You know, it's just astonishing that all that stuff makes me angry. But yeah, I don't like tornadoes either.
You're not being angry about something.
Oh yeah, no, I'm trying to get my goat. But anyway, so can I read something about? I'd like to read something about Barb, who I love dearly, and who Barb, she came off a farm, and Barb was a big fat girl, and she got a lot of crap for it, and she was judged as not beautiful, and you can imagine how Carver feels about her, because Carver's got his who's what, and who's, you know, who's good, who's bad, who's pretty, who's not. And she met Mopsik. She actually met Mopsik. She was working at Honeywell. She found herself making cluster bombs, which she knew very little about. And when she found out that's what she was really doing, she left. But, you know, people would come in and demonstrate. And one day she finally took her time card, tore it up, threw it on the floor, opened her little locker, you know, with a cup of soup and all that stuff that's in there, and she left and she went and stood with people outside. So Barb's a pretty cool woman, but she's ill. Good mother anyway, went up and went to work. So this is towards the, this talks about Barb and how she feels about herself, and has to do with her illness in part. Barb could feel it, her flesh house falling away, the prison of it. This was the fulfillment of all those days, those nights, when she told herself it didn't matter, that the body wasn't her true home, just a temporary address, ugliness, the signpost of a moment. Being in this life, that was the dream. But such a real dream, and she inhaled the smell of baby powder and her own daughter with breasts full of milk like a grown woman. Such a beautiful dream, her husband climbing into bed when he could sit up and watch her no longer. August stroking her cheek, her arms, and she, Barb, falling asleep in his embrace. Such a real dream to be in this body and learn what it needed to teach her. She sat up. She pushed down the blanket and pulled up an inch at a time, her big nightgown with its dance of roses spiraling toward her. It was caught beneath her, but she had to see, she had to know what was falling away, what she had dreamt all these years. The cloth scraped her flesh, but then she could see the house of the body she'd been dreaming, and she wondered who had dreamt it first. What god had lain drunk and in the tremors of the night formed her, a great drunken world full of caves and crevices in the hills and long curves scored by glaciers by the sharp weight of ice. The covers cast away, there she was, all dream. Flesh dimpled and scarred, her belly still round, her breast still dreaming, the nipples drooping to each side of her chest. Cockeyed breast, she laughed, and then grabbed at the covers in case someone would hear her, walk in and see her there in her awful house, her ramshackle costume. She laughed again, still alive there in her laugh. Dead weight, is that what they would say when they tried to move her? She'd read chapters of Gulliver's Travels with Angie. She could see the tiny men swarming over her with ropes and pulleys to try to lift her. But then she saw how her legs had grown thin and her arms, even her fingers, had not the same thickness, the same journey around, and she knew it was true. The awful house was falling away. The wind entered the screens and stirred the air around her. She remembered the dress that swirled up like white petals to show off the long, firm stems of legs that stayed planted even in the wind, the view of the body obscured by the painted fingernails that tacked down the skirt at the place of desire. She knew the famous woman, the blonde Marilyn, had been caught by the camera standing over an open grate, and that her legs were parted wide to give her balance on her high-heeled shoes over the darkness below. She wondered at what was hidden of the famous body, and then at the whole back of her own body, lost forever to her scrutiny. She squirmed and remembered her behind, how it moved under dresses and waves, dismissed. Desire, too, she recalled. Men whispered at her, and she still heard the things they'd said and burned with embarrassment. She recalled the day she decided that nothing she couldn't see could hurt her and gave up staring at herself in the mirror and weeping there, begging God for beauty. She saw all the pretty faces turn to look at her, the fat girl, focus on her with eyes thick-lashed and heavy-lidded, pure blue, deep brown, ocean green, filled with the old scorn. She'd walked out of one house, out of one town. She would walk out of this one, too, and be free of what flashed at her from magazine pages and television screens, from the thick-voiced movies that appeared from behind old velvet curtains, free from the ever-present gaggle of teenage girls at the mall, their tumble of perfect limb and precise pour of breast, their hair that fell like magic over the forgotten skull and its electrical sponge that was not beautiful, that was not the color of cloud or flower or rare dark wood, of berry or spice or intoxication, but a gray sponge sparked to frenzy by the deep charge and wild turnings of the feeling mind that knew nothing of the embroidery of hair that sat above it and veiled its true artist. She'd walk out of the belly sag and the crushed breasts and the pitted garment, the ragged crown and the shriveled lips. She'd leap out of her own eye sockets. She'd storm the barricades of flesh, and she remembered that the workers in 19th century Paris, the poor with their wooden shoes and their weary, soot-encrusted faces, hungry for better, storming the barricades and bursting through the prison walls. And she would, excuse me, and she would, she'd storm the barricades of flesh, and she remembered that the workers in 19th century Paris, the poor with their wooden shoes and their weary, soot-encrusted faces, hungry for better, storming the barricades and bursting through the prison walls, and she would, she vowed, burst through her body, burst through and pull her heart from it, like a madman rips a phone out of the wall. Only this would not be to disconnect, but to take her heart with her and connect it to the great heart of earth, the great heart of creation. She looked down at her dry, broken feet. She'd never walk out of here, she thought, but she'd fly, fly out of herself. Tell them, she yelled, this is not me. Tell them, she whispered, afraid to look for me in the beautiful things. I'll be there, she thought, in the lightning strikes, in the sudden reaching down from the sky. She looked at her feet, her legs, her belly, her breasts. I'll be there in the land. Sit with me, she cried out. And August ran in and held her and put his hand everywhere she hated and would leave. And then she wanted to stay always in this house that she loved like no other. I probably should have been a Jungian, but I don't have time to read all those four. because I think that clearly I'm in. If I look at it, I'm in all of them. But it's not a question of thinking that I'm working with myself. It's sort of characters are kind of born, and I think that you don't really know fully how much you're in them until they've had their way and the story is developed, and then you suddenly look at them and you go, oh my God, this is familiar and this is familiar and this is me and this is inside me. And so I think the stuff of a life is it only looks like a package. It only looks like it has one name, but I think it really is.
It's a very descriptive.
Anybody else? Or?
This isn't your first novel, though, is it?
This is my. I have two books of poetry and a novella, and this is my first novel. And I'm in the middle of the second one, and I really would like to finish it. So I can write the third.
Well, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. And there's books for sale up in front, and I know if I have it to sign them. Writers need your support, and so do bookstores. So they help us all by buying some books and give them to your friends too. And thanks again, and hope to see you soon.